This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm with Scott Eyman. The book is Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collide. I recommend the book. I picked it up. I didn't know anything. Now I don't know anything. Plus, I know what Scott has guided me to learn more about, which is early Hollywood, when men and women invented an art form that dominates the solar system and will forever. The idea of telling a magical story on a stage that moves. We're going now to a success of Limelight and Charlie Chaplin's decision with his growing family and his devoted wife, Una. They're going to travel to London and Europe in order to enjoy the opening of Limelight in London and then tour some with his young family, including Geraldine Chaplin, who will become a movie star on her own once in the future. We're looking at, though, days when you needed a visa to come back to the country after leaving it. And in order to get that, you had to apply for the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS. It's important now to establish that this wouldn't have been the first occasion that Charlie brushed up against the INS. Remember, the FBI's been tracking him since 22. With nothing. Hedda Hopper and Ed Sullivan, whom I will never celebrate again, have been hectoring him for decades for unknown reasons of their own, perhaps their own personalities, but for no evidence whatsoever that Charlie Chaplin did anything wrong. However, at one point, I believe it's April of 48, a man named Boyd at the INS interviews Charlie Chaplin, and the INS is now part of the decision-making. The idea is, if Charlie Chaplin leaves, we won't let him come back. Whose idea was it, Scott? Who came up with this genius smear?
It appears to have been James McGranary, the attorney general, Harry Truman's attorney general, as a matter of fact. McGranary was an ardent Catholic, and he was deeply offended by Chaplin's relationships with women. The Chaplin's marriage to Una was completely stable and basically a model of monogamy was of little import to McGranary because he was still judging Chaplin by the scandalous treatment of that had been dealt with in the press over the Joan Barry case and one or two of his marriages. Chaplin and Una and their four children, they had eight total, but they only had four at this point, 1952. It's September of 1952. They're on the Queen Elizabeth sailing to London. One day out of New York, they got a wire that his reentry permit had been revoked pending an investigation. And that he would have to reapply for a reentry permit if he chose to come back. Well, what he didn't know was that about a week after the reentry permit was revoked, there was a meeting at the INS. And basically they came to the decision that if he came back, they were going to have to let him back in the country because he'd never been convicted of anything, not a misdemeanor, not a felony, nothing. No, he'd never broken the law as far as the federal government was concerned. But Chaplin didn't know that. In any case, Chaplin's back was up. He was enraged at being kicked out of his adopted country, which is something he never would have left on his own. He had just spent a serious amount of money expanding his house on Summit Drive because of all the children he and Una were having. He needed to enlarge the house, which he had just done about 8 months previously, which he wouldn't have done if he was planning on bailing. So he clearly was here for the duration, but the revocation forced him into deciding what to do with the rest of his life. If he wasn't going to live in California, how would he get his films out? How would he get his money out, his stocks and bonds? Everything he owned was in America. And where would he live? So these were a huge number of balls that he had to juggle in the air. He worked very fast. This happened in September of 1952. In less than 6 months, he bought a manor house in Switzerland where he lived for the rest of his life. Una had gone back to America. She had been born here, so she was a citizen. And she closed out his accounts and his bank accounts. His brother Sidney came to the rescue and moved from Florida to Los Angeles to close out the studio and to handle all the hardware at the studio and whatever else Una could not take care of because she only came back for about a week to take care of the financial aspects of the Chaplin estate. So Sidney basically hung around for several years, liquidating the rest of it. And it was Sidney's suggestion, actually, that Chaplin consider Switzerland. Chaplin initially thought, well, maybe London, maybe England. But I don't think he really wanted to go back and immerse himself in all those memories that England had for him. You know, I think Switzerland, there were obvious tax advantages, which were of considerable importance to Sidney. Sidney spent most of his life devising wild schemes to avoid paying income tax. And Charlie was not terribly well disposed towards paying income tax either, although he always paid everything he owed to the U.S. government, certainly. All the audits he had to endure proved that. So he decided to settle in Switzerland. He also needed to lower the temperature. I mean, he'd endured a lot since 1942, since the Russian speeches, the Joan Baez thing, Monsieur Verdoux. He needed to lower the temperature, and Switzerland's a good place to lower the temperature because there's not a lot to do in Switzerland. You know, the seasons come, the seasons go, the snow mounts up in the winter. It's very quiet. It's very restful. It's also a little dull. And the flip side to moving to Switzerland was he kind of began to drift, I think, in a creative manner, creatively. He was no longer forced to be on point like you are in New York, like you are in London or Paris or Madrid or Los Angeles, for that matter, you know, where it's an environment that demands you pay attention to what's going on around you, if only to cross the street. In Switzerland, you don't have to worry about things like that. You can just relax. And Chaplin was cosseted by his money, his estate, raising his children. He had a lot of other things to do, finally. So he kind of settled back into a quasi-retirement that involved only two more movies for the rest of his life, which was another 25 years. And he wrote a very good memoir, which I commend to anybody that's listening, if you haven't already read it, and enjoyed his estate and enjoyed his children and enjoyed his marriage.
I want to speak of the two movies, because the movies are evidence of what you say, that he lost the inspiration that he found in California and in America.
Yes.
Or
yes.
The Little Tramp. The first is The King in America.
King in New York.
King in New York, which struck me as a bad idea right away. And I found a clip of it. I haven't seen the movie. It's ghastly. I wonder what's going on here. Where's he going with this? He made it to the Shepperton studio, and that might be an explanation. It wasn't his place.
He had built his own studio in 1918, and all of his films after 1918 had been made at the Chaplin studio on La Brea, which is now the home of the Jim Henson Company. There's a delightful statue of Kermit the Frog dressed as the tramp mounted on the chimney. Very charming. And everything he'd done, so that he was master of his domain, to use Jerry Seinfeld's phrase. It was a little kingdom. He was comfortable there. It was homey. It was a city block, small studio, but perfect for his needs. And when he wasn't working, he would rent it out to independent companies that wanted to shoot there. So it was like a second home for him. And losing both his actual home on Summit Drive and his second home, the studio, I think it left him a little at sea, almost literally at sea. He didn't feel comfortable working at other studios. And during the production of King in New York, he was blocking a scene with some actors, and he picked up a chair and moved it. And they promptly called a strike. The crew promptly went on strike, because the director's not allowed to move props, you know, only the grips are allowed to move props. And they called a strike. And now Chaplin was a politically liberal, but he said they're going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs if they're going to go on strike because a director moves a chair. He just thought that was manifestly insane. But he didn't know about English unions, which were very, very strong at that point. He had no concept of things like that. So he was a little taken aback by things like that, because he hadn't had to worry about things like that in Los Angeles at the Chaplin studio.
That took me to the workhouse, Scott. Took me to the workhouse, and what he said repeatedly through his life, he cannot abide authority telling him what he has to do.
No, no. He had to have absolute autonomy. All of his life after the Carnot Company is essentially building walls to guarantee his own autonomy. Whether it was founding United or co-founding United Artists in 1920, building his own studio in 1918, financing his own films, he answered to no one, no one. And suddenly he has to, you know, search for distribution for the two films he made in Europe. Had to be disconcerting for him and uncomfortable for him, because the cost of making movies was increasing in the 1950s and 60s, past the point where he felt comfortable financing them himself. It's simply King of New York. He financed himself for a B movie budget. He spent much less money on that than he spent on Limelight, because he was getting nervous. But and so it looks like it's a film that isn't really thought out, and the shooting doesn't have the precision of the shooting of Limelight, for instance. Because he's in a hurry, because he's worried about money. And that was just a function of changing times, and the times were changing in ways that did not play to his strengths. And also, he's getting older. Let's face it. He's in his, when he comes to make King of New York, he's pushing 70 years old. And 70 is kind of a breaking point for directors. There are very few directors that make good movies in their eighth decade. I can think of one. John Huston, I think, made a great movie at 80. Kurosawa made some good movies in his 70s, but there aren't a huge number of directors who do. Generally, that's when the director begins to fall off, and Chaplin falls off as well.
One more movie, Brando, Chaplin. Do they go together? I'm John Batchelor.